Okay, good afternoon. Today I have Local Government Minister Nick Smith with me to announce a number of changes we're making to the local government sector. New Zealand's 78 councils make up 4% of GDP, spending $7.5 billion of public money each year and manage $100 billion worth of assets. They also perform a huge range of regulatory functions that affect households and businesses. Local government, like central government, needs to deliver better services to New Zealanders within tight financial constraints. Ratepayers require the assurance that their council is spending their money wisely on the services that matter to them. The changes we are announcing today aim to improve the performance of local government and form part of our broader agenda to build a more competitive and productive economy. These changes in legislation will be implemented by a local government reform bill later this year. Councils may be able to play their part, in economic growth. That means cutting red tape, minimising the rates burden on households and businesses, limiting debt and providing high quality infrastructure at the lowest possible cost. Firstly, we will streamline the purpose of local government. Its primary role will be to provide for good quality local infrastructure, public services and regulation at the best possible value to homes and businesses. This means councils will be able to focus on the services that only they can deliver rather than having to spread their resources too thinly to meet the current broad remit of the purpose statement. We will also introduce fiscal responsibility requirements for councils, which will be developed in consultation with local government in New Zealand. These regulations will set benchmarks for councils' performance regarding income, expenditure and debt levels. Debt is a critical issue for councils. Within households, businesses and farms, while households, businesses and farms have reined in debt in response to the global financial crisis, the local government sector has not. Since 2002, council debt has increased from approximately $2 billion to a touch over $8 billion. A significant factor in the rate's rise most New Zealanders have faced has been the escalating salary costs since the Local Government Act came into force in 2002. From 2002 to 2010, salary costs increased by a staggering 82%. In the past 3 years, labour costs in local government have increased by 7.6%, nearly double the rate of the state sector. Unless council spending is brought under control, debt and rates will continue to rise. These fiscal requirements will be linked to the third change we're making, strengthening council governance provisions. The new mechanism will be used in situations where central government can provide assistance to a struggling council before the situation becomes critical, or when a council has failed to meet the fiscal responsibility requirements. The framework for intervention will be changed to a graduated one, ranging from minimal engagement to maximum intervention. We will also strengthen the powers of communities' elected representatives. We will extend some aspects of the Auckland mayoral model to local councils, and we'll give councillors the ability to set employment and remuneration policies. Councils will also be required to report salary information in their annual reports, just as central government agencies do now. We also believe there's an opportunity for efficiency gains in the reorganisation of councils. We will legislate to make it easier for a community to make changes to its council structure by simplifying the requirements for a reorganisation proposal. This will also give the Local Government Commission greater flexibility in considering such proposals. These four changes will be completed next year by further reforms to improve the local government sector. There is also work being done on the overall framework of regulatory functions between central and local government, a job to be done in parallel with the Productivity Commission. So those are four basic ingredients of the bill that we're proposing to introduce in a few months' time. I'm going to pass over to Nick Smith. He'll have a few comments to make, then we'll take any questions on local government, and then we'll just resume normal Monday afternoon press conference.
I just wanted to emphasise a couple of the points that the Prime Minister has made. This reform is about putting tighter restraints on council spending and debt, while at the same time making sure that we provide the tools for our councils to be able to better manage those costs. It is our view that the 2002 Local Government Act set the role of councils as too broad and ill-defined. However, we don't want to return the sort of pedantic 1974 Act that resulted in councils, for instance, having to get a special act of parliament to have an illuminated town clock or those sorts of type provisions. The new purpose takes a balanced approach that focuses councils on their core roles of providing local infrastructure, providing local public services, and those local regulatory functions at least cost to households and businesses, but it's also sufficiently flexible to recognise the pretty diverse range of communities that councils have from Kaitaia to Bluff. The important words in the new purpose statement is firstly local, to separate out that they are not to redo stuff that is the responsibility of central government, and secondly public, to make plain that they are not there to duplicate functions that are done by the private sector. We are making moderate changes to the way that councils can be reorganised. This is not about central government deciding the best local structure, but rather providing a mechanism by which there can be community-led change. We do not come from a perspective that big is automatically better, albeit we do take the view that simpler is better, and that is why we are making provision for the expansion of the unitary council model, quite explicit in the criteria for the local government commission. The last point I wish to make is that this is a balanced and comprehensive package. We recognise there are issues in the statutory requirements on councils that are bureaucratic and costly, and we're committed to working with councils to make it more efficient to do those things. We also appreciate councils' perspective that government needs to think carefully about the delegation of regulatory roles, thus the work that the Prime Minister has spoken of respect to the Productivity Commission. The further point is the focus on the costs of infrastructure and how government can help local government actually purchase its infrastructure more efficiently. The purpose of these reforms is to get a change in direction from the 7% every year increase in rates over the last decade and that quadrupling in debt. These reforms are about getting rate increases closer to the rate of inflation and supporting the government's overall program around economic reform. Thanks.
So why not cap those rates increases?
I think there's a tension between government providing a framework for local government and some checks without us being a nanny state that doesn't allow communities to make a reasonable range of choices about what level of service they want in their local community and what prepared rates they're prepared to have. Where I think the government does need to take a greater interest is around the level of debt of councils. Ultimately, if a council goes broke, the truth is it's going to fall on government's plate. There were legislative provisions previously that limited the amount of debt that councils could get themselves into. Thankfully, in New Zealand, we've never had a council go broke, although I have to say I'm very worried about the level of debt that a council like Kaipara has now incurred. And so this is quite a moderate approach of saying, yes, we're going to give councils a lot of flexibility, but there does need to be some limits that are set down through those new fiscal responsibility requirements.
What's going on in the life of Kaipara? Is that acceptable? These people have to face a 20% rate spike. I mean, nobody can want to pay that.
No, what's happened in Kaipara is not acceptable. And they're not the only council that's incurred quite large increases in debts and in rates, and that is why we need the sorts of reforms that we're proposing today.
Well, you effectively are putting a cap on rates and debt, aren't you, by limiting the amount of how they can increase their expenditure. It's just a cap through the back door, isn't it?
Well, what we're doing is we're setting down fiscal responsibility requirements, and we're saying that prudent councils need to work within these margins. What we're announcing today is that we're going to amend the Local Government Act to enable the government to put those fiscal responsibility requirements in place. The legislation is going to make explicit that we have to work with local government, New Zealand and councils about deciding what are those fair parameters around increases in council spending and around levels of debt. And I think when you see the detail of those, you'll see that councils do have some flexibility, albeit it's in the national interest, that councils do not incur the sorts of scale of debt increase and rate increase that we've seen over the last decade.
But you're proposing that to limit that no faster than inflation or population growth? Like
What we've said in those fiscal responsibility requirements that will be determined by regulation is that there will be a component that will be set down around inflation, around population increase. There will be an exemption for natural disasters. Obviously, Christchurch Council's got humongous costs associated with the recovery that would not be fair. Interestingly, all those three components are in the confidence and supply limits on increases in central government expenditure, so we're asking no more of councils than what we have as central government imposed on ourselves. There may also be provision for exemptions around situations where, for instance, the Environment Court may require a council to proceed with a major investment, say, in the heads of sewerage or other infrastructure. And they are details to be worked out through regulation with local government New Zealand. And I am confident that we can come up with a set of regulations that most councils will say is a pretty reasonable set of fiscal responsibility requirements.
In terms of removing reference to the cultural, social, environmental well-being of communities, I mean, what sort of spend do you expect that will cut out? What sort of activities will it stop?
It's quite difficult to be able to look back over the last decade and be able to specifically cut off how much of it's been from councils expanding their roles, how much of it has been from some of the other components and rate increases. What we do know is that the single biggest item of increased cost for councils over the last decade has been in their salaries cost. There's been quite big growth in that area, and that's why in this package we've provided them with some specific tools in this regard. In terms of the overall picture, what we do know is that prior to the 2002 Act, for the decade previous, rate increases were going up at 3.9% per year. In the decade since, they've been going up at 7% per year. I think the only fair conclusion to come to is both the bureaucratic requirements and the expansion of the purpose of local government have cost councils and ratepayers considerably more. I note the figures that if rates had continued to increase at a similar rate of the previous decade, the average household today would be spending $500 a year less on rates, and the economy as a whole would be spending $1 billion less on rates.
Well, for instance, I mean, most councils these days have economic development agencies. Would you expect those to be scrapped as a result of these?
Well, they are, and this is where we're quite deliberately saying it is the role of councils to provide local public services. Central government actually provides economic development services through an agency like Trade and Enterprise New Zealand. I think there is an appropriate role for councils to play in that area, albeit councils have to ask the same tough questions as we do of Trade and Enterprise, that we're getting good value for money. So you should not take from this change in purpose that councils will not have any role in the sort of that economic development area. I'll take an area like environment. The Resource Management Act sets down very specific obligations for councils around the environment. But it's not this broad-based purpose that we had in the Local Government Act that let them go well beyond the mere purposes of the Resource Management Act. And that's where I don't think that very broad purpose covering economic, social, cultural and environmental well-being basically said that councils could do absolutely everything. And the truth is that both central government and the private sector have important roles around all of those.
You specifically mentioned, I think, here that councils have nothing to do with the NCA results.
Yep.
And I think last week you said a national target of 85% for NCA too, but don't actually you think local councils can have a role sort of collaborating with local schools about how they try and make achievement locally?
Well, I think the real danger of that is that ratepayers are also taxpayers. And when we're trying to look for greater efficiency, I think New Zealand is far better to have a Ministry of Education and a school sector that's really focused on delivering that NCA. And I'm not sure that councils can add value to improving those educational achievement. And effectively what we're saying in these local government reforms is actually having local government with about 4% of GDP involved in every possible area is actually not that efficient or effective. We're better getting them focused on those things that only they can do and doing them really well.
How are councils local governments for investing in things like arts festivals or fireworks displays or katahaka?
Well, you see, all of those are in the discretionary element of what you would see as public services. So, you know, are councils going to be able to be involved in providing fireworks displays? Yes, if that's their choice, that is a range of public service. Where I think councils will have difficulty is we've got some councils out there buying farms. I think that's pretty difficult to fit that within the definition of the new purpose.
Sorry? An arts festival, for instance, is a cultural event. Why
sure.
Would they not be, why would they be allowed to invest in that?
Because quite clearly, in the range of local public services, would include things such as, just in the same way as the central government, contributes to a range of functions and events of that sort. What it is doing is saying, and these are the two key changes, is that they need to be focused on those things that are local, not national. And the second thing is, as I've said, they need to focus on those things that are public services rather than those that are provided by the private sector. If you take a fireworks display, the truth is, and if you look at some of the more academic literature about providing for a definition of a public service, is those things that it's not possible to individually price, and actually a fireworks display is one of those things that it's very difficult to actually individually charge everybody that might enjoy
on
those
the
fireworks.
On the debt, sorry,
coming
back to
about the debt. Do you expect the debt some of those non-core events then being limited?
Events?
Yeah, like fireworks displays.
No, I've just made plain, is that if a council chooses to be involved in something like fireworks or those activities, they could be deemed within that local public service function, exactly the same way as central government. So what we're broadly saying is the current purpose is way out here. We're bringing it in a bit, but there's still a huge amount of discretion for councils in how they define what is local infrastructure, what is local public services, as well as what are those appropriate local regulatory functions that we need our councils to do well.
Who's going to talk about that 2% salary increase? Is there anything more that you can do to limit salaries, especially those of
seniors? Well, the interesting contrast is that for us elected representatives in central government, we have had the capacity to set both caps within the public sector and to set remuneration policy across the central government bureaucracy. And that has been employed with some success over the last 3 years in getting the cost of the core public service down. Now, the local government legislation does not give our mayors and councils the powers to do that. And we're saying, if we're going to ask these councils to better manage their costs, we need to give them more tools, and that is why this package includes amendments to the Local Government Act to specifically enable them to do exactly what central government's been doing over the last 3 years.
I mean, ultimately from a ratepayer's perspective, one of the biggest costs is ultimately the cost of employment and staffing down at the council. So one thing we're doing here is giving much greater transparency. So as a matter of course, they'll have to report on the amount of staff they have, the increases in staff, and the salary bands of those staff. When we applied the same sort of transparency to MPs' expenses, we had over time seen quite a dramatic decrease in those costs. And I think the reality is, the more transparency there is, the greater likelihood it is that there'll be a change in behaviour. And if we want to really rein in those costs, we need local government to know that their actions will be held to account by those who have much better information.
So is there a chance then that those salary bands could be dropped?
Well, I think there's certainly every chance that they'll employ less people. I think that they will have to work much more aggressively to share services. I think they'll have to be much more focused on the people that they employ, and I think they will be very cautious about the sort of pay increases that we saw in Christchurch, where Tony Merritt was at one point awarded a 14% wage increase, $68,000. I just don't think that would happen under a system which is much more public in the way this has been.
Have you done any work on the numbers of how many people will lose jobs?
No, and ultimately that will be a choice for those councils. If you ask me in broad terms what's the objective of this package, it is not my expectation to see overall rate decreases. It is my expectation across the local government sector to see rate increases more about the rate of inflation than the period of the last decade when they've been more than double.
I'm just talking about job losses though, and that's it. Have you done any work on how many people
No, because ultimately councils are still going to have a significant amount of flexibility to be able to work what are the choices for their communities. What I certainly would wish to see is that the growth in staff numbers within the local government sector to plateau rather than the increase that we've seen over the last decade.
I think one thing that's fair to say though is if you look at the reforms in Auckland, I mean, ultimately bringing those eight councils together is sort of quite a substantial reduction in the support staff required for the new Auckland Super City. And what this package today does is change the balance of probability that there will be reorganisation within the communities and councils. And if that's the case, then I think over time you actually can see a more efficient, cheaper operating environment. And again, I think that's good for ratepayers. In the end, someone's got to pay the bill here, and it's either this generation or future generations through high levels of debt, and ultimately ratepayers every time they pay their rates bill. And we can't have a situation, I think, where you have endless compound rate increases of 7%. I think for those particularly on fixed income, they can't afford to keep paying that bill, and something's got to give. And what's going to give is a more efficient, I think, a more effective local government sector.
So is it your expectation that there will be more amalgamations, more unitary authorities, fewer regional councils? And what sort of time frames are we talking?
Yeah, we are quite deliberately timing the legislative program to give some communities that have expressed an ambition for reorganising their councils to be able to do so in time for the October 2013 local body elections. That is having these new provisions in place by the end of September this year. Exactly which communities are going to choose, that is for them and the local government commission to decide. So how many there might be, we don't know. That is ultimately for those communities to make that choice.
But would it be your preference to see more of the super city model around the country?
Certainly the government is changing the criteria to be considered by the Commission where there are proposals for reform. Firstly, in terms of favouring those that simplify the planning processes. It is our view that where you can get unitary councils, just like in Auckland, it makes it a whole lot less complicated than having both a regional council and a whole series of district and city councils. Secondly, we're changing the criteria to that the Commission has to be satisfied that there is significant community support across the district, and the third is that we are putting greater emphasis in the criteria on those efficiency and savings gains, because that's a key part of the reform package.
But you're making it easier for amalgamation, so you must think that's the way forward.
Yes, it is our view that in some parts of New Zealand there are efficiency gains, just as we saw in Auckland, from councils merging, but we don't have a fixed view that there are these particular communities that should change, that there are particularly areas where those reforms would be advantageous. What we are saying to councils, you need to have a hard look at your own structure in your own area to see whether it is the most efficient structure of local government that there can be to serve your community.
I think we also have.
Well, I think we also have the view that historically it's been too difficult to see change. I mean, there's been 8 applications, all of them have failed, with the exception of Banks Peninsula coming into Christchurch, and even then it took an exceptional act by Banks Peninsula. So generally speaking, previous chances, if you like, to see amalgamation have all failed, and I think that tells you that the dial's set in slightly the wrong place.
This Productivity Commission look into the regulatory role of the government. Will that include, do you think, how they manage urban limits?
Well, the Productivity Commission has already produced a quite substantive report around the issue of metropolitan urban limits and how that impacts on housing affordability. It's actually during the course of that work that the Productivity Commission has expressed a broader interest in what takes place within the local government regulatory environment. We also think the Productivity Commission can, as an independent body, provide some balance to this big debate about what regulatory functions are best done by central government and what are best done locally. Inevitably, central and local government will have a little bit of vested interest in that discussion, so I think they can add value. So the Productivity Commission's work is going to be developed through terms of reference. We want to consult with Local Government New Zealand about those. Myself and the Minister of Finance, whose responsibility is the Productivity Commission, will be announcing in 2 or 3 weeks' time the terms of reference for that important piece of work around that regulatory stuff.
So what are your views in terms of urban limits and who should be controlling them? Should the government have more of a say? Because, well, as you say in here, it's about New Zealand's productivity. And
I tell you why I'm hesitant to answer that, for this reason. The Productivity Commission has produced a report on housing affordability. That currently is out for public consultation. If we are to respect the independent role of the Productivity Commission, I think we should let them finish their work, report to government, and for us then to draw our conclusions about what change might be required.
You put a lot of emphasis on the rise in debt from 2 billion to 8 billion, a fourfold increase over 10 years. The government's debt has gone from 8 billion to 50 billion, which is a sixfold plus increase in 4 years. I mean, isn't this sort of do as we say, not do as we do?
Yeah, but there's a substantial difference, right? So central government has the virtually unlimited levers at its disposal in terms of raising taxes, raising revenue, in the event that it's required to meet that debt liability. Councils don't. They have one lever, it's called rates. unless they have other assets that they own, that's the only thing that they can change. So they have a much lower probability that they can actually meet that. And secondly, local government cannot go broke. So in the end, in the event that there is a huge build-up of debt and a liability that can't be met, that would have to fall on the central government. So in the end, it's about the capability. And for a government to be running debt, which is in the order of mid-20s of GDP, is not only low international, but more than acceptable to the rating agency. Very different deal for local government.
The other important difference I would make is that if you look at the long-term plans that are being projected over the next 10 years, local government is looking to increase its borrowing, and a very core part of the government's program is actually to reduce that borrowing and to get to balance by year 2015-16. So if I saw the same sort of changes in central government direction around debt occurring in the local government sector, I'd be hugely encouraged.
Why don't you trust the democratic process to rein in the councils that allow these kinds of increases in debt or rates to occur?
Because a very important role for government is to set the legislative framework for our local councils. And one of the key parts of this reform that I think we need to re-look at, and as part of the program, is that councils produce these absolutely voluminous, up to 800 pages long, of long-term plans, of which you need to read to about the 600th page to find out what's occurring with your local council debt. In my view, we need to provide the legislative framework in which those core issues, like debt and costs, are more transparent, rather than being buried in the massive bureaucratic requirements that the 2002 Act imposed on those councils.
Does this effectively remove power of general competence? How does it affect that?
Well, there's a lot of talk about the sort of power of general competence and it being introduced in 2002. Technically speaking, it doesn't exist in those frames. What, in practice and law, the power of general competence was introducing this role for councils of having this very broad responsibility across the social, economic, environmental and cultural well-being. So it is true to say that the government is pulling in that power of general competence back to these three core areas of providing local infrastructure, local public services, and local regulatory roles.
We can see these changes having any impact on the provision of social housing?
Well, social housing, and again I make the analogy with central government, is that the government accepts that part of the public services that we provide is the provision of state housing for communities, and equally so with councils. So within that definition of being able to provide local public services is the capacity for councils to be able to provide that some of those local community housing needs.
We seem to go through this process, this debate around core public services or core council services when Rodney Hyde was minister. So why didn't you take it all then? Why is this just suddenly emerged now?
Well, this is a pretty logical progression. During Rodney Hyde's period, he did, in my view, a very good job of that massive reform in Auckland. In February last year, he announced a work program. I think it was called Smarter Government, Better Local Communities. And these questions were asked in that work program. Officials have been doing work that was included in my briefing as the incoming minister. And this package of reform builds on that piece of work that Rodney Hyde initiated last February.
Wasn't there an amendment that passed in 2010 that was supposed to have greater financial transparency and also focus councils on their core services?
Yes.
Was that a failure?
No, rather this piece of work builds on it. And in fact, if you look back at the submissions that were made to the Select Committee and in the briefings that I received as the incoming minister, questions were raised that there was a disconnect between those new requirements and this very broad purpose statement. And so effectively this is a natural progression on the work that Rodney Hyde began.
Okay, thank you.
Would you support a parliamentary inquiry into the practice of hydraulic fracking?
There's been questions around fracking, and the Green Party ironically has been calling for a moratorium. Can I tell you why a moratorium on fracking is somewhat contradictory? Many people don't realise that fracking is an activity that is required as part of geothermal energy development, and I do find it very ironic that the very party that's promising 100,000 jobs from renewable technology that particularly focuses on geothermal energy is also going to be achieved by putting a ban on one of the activities that's required to be able to develop geothermal energy. Now, we've received reports, both Phil Heatley and myself, around whether the regulatory environment around fracking is adequate. The work that's been done in the Taranaki region has suggested that there's been no environmental issues with fracking in that region. The international evidence is that there are issues with fracking where it is used in quite shallow shales for the extraction of petroleum. All of the fracking that has been done in New Zealand and proposed to date is at very deep levels, where we cannot find any international evidence of adverse environmental impacts. I note the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment is giving some consideration independently as to whether she's going to have an inquiry. I think that the government's approach as to whether there should be a select committee look at it will wait till after the Parliamentary Commission has decided whether she's going to do it, and our view would not be a good use of resources to have the Parliamentary Commissioner for the Environment and a select committee of Parliament kicking the tyres around our regulatory framework for fracking.
Okay, let me move on. I'd like to acknowledge with sadness the death of the King of Tonga. King George Tupou V died in Hong Kong last night, and our thoughts are with the people of Tonga at this time. He will also be sadly missed by the Tongan community here in New Zealand. New Zealand has strong, close and friendly relationships with Tonga, and with deep ties at a personal level and frequent contact at all levels of government. I'd like to acknowledge the very valuable contribution the King of Tonga has made in steering Tonga towards democracy, and hope this work will continue. I've visited the King and enjoyed his fine hospitality in Tonga, and I enjoyed hosting His Majesty on a state visit to New Zealand last year. My understanding is that arrangements for the King's funeral in Tonga are yet unknown. It is my expectation I can get out of here in a few moments to ring the Prime Minister of Tonga. Probably stay a bit late, so we'll see how it goes. Let's move on to Korea. This said they'll be travelling to the Republic of Korea to attend the second Nuclear Security Summit in Seoul, which is happening next Monday and Tuesday. The Nuclear Security Summit process is an initiative of the American President Barack Obama, and our objective is to work towards securing nuclear materials and reducing the global threat from nuclear terrorism. As one of the 50 countries invited to take part in the summit, New Zealand is committed to playing its part in this important event. My visit also coincides with the 50th anniversary of the establishment of diplomatic relations between New Zealand and the Republic of Korea, and this year has also been designated the Korea-New Zealand Year of Friendship. I'll also be holding a bilateral meeting with President Lee on Sunday ahead of the summit to discuss further strengthening the relationship between our two countries. One of my aims on this visit will be to progress negotiations on the bilateral FTA with Korea. Korea is currently our fifth largest trading partner with two-way trade worth around about $3 billion. I'll also use the opportunity of the summit to have bilateral meetings with some of the leaders there, including the Prime Minister of the Netherlands, Thailand, Vietnam, and the Deputy PM of the United Kingdom, Nick Clegg. I'll arrive back in New Zealand on Wednesday, the 28th of March. This weekend we'll also see the return of the Super Rugby to Christchurch with the Crusaders' first home game in the city for nearly 2 years, since May 2010. Crusaders will be facing the Cheetahs at the new Christchurch Stadium in Addington at 7.35 on Saturday night. Fortunately, I'll miss the game due to the visit to Korea, but I hope to visit the completed stadium for another game in the near future. The contractors involved in this project have done a remarkable job. It's an incredible feat to build an 18,000-seat facility in less than 100 days. I visited the stadium a few weeks ago while it was under construction, and it looked fantastic. Cost for the temporary stadium was underwritten by the government, with funding support from the Christchurch City Council, the New Zealand Rugby Football Union and the Christchurch Earthquake Appeal Trust. Much of the infrastructure at the Christchurch Stadium was recycled from other venues. Four stadium lights were transported from Dunedin's Carisbrook Ground. The turf and public address system from AMI Stadium was used. Food and beverage outlets, temporary seating toilet blocks came from Eden Park. The completion of this stadium means Cantabrians will once again be able to experience the excitement of major sporting events, concerts and festivals after the damaged facilities sustained in the earthquakes. It also sends a strong signal that Christchurch is open for business and on the road to recovery. Talking of roads, next Monday also sees the completion of the first of our seven roads of national significance, with the opening of the third lane in the Victoria Park Tunnel in Auckland. The tunnel first opened to traffic in November 2011, and this is the final stage of its completion. At the same time, an additional afternoon rush hour lane will be opened through St Mary's Bay to Auckland's Harbour Bridge. This means for the first time there will be 5 lanes through St Mary's Bay, matching 5 lanes on the bridge. This is fantastic news for Auckland motorists. Construction on the $340 million Victoria Park Tunnel project started in late 2009, and its benefits are being delivered to drivers 3 months ahead of schedule. The additional lanes through Victoria Park Tunnel and St Mary's Bay will have a significant impact on travel times and safety through Auckland Central Motorway Junction, one of the most heavily congested sections of State Highway in New Zealand. The project addresses the last major bottleneck on State Highway 1 between the Auckland Harbour Bridge and Newmarket. Meanwhile, in Wellington, the $50 million upgrade to the Terrace Tunnel is nearly complete and will be officially opened this Sunday. The upgrade involved firefighting, lighting, ventilation, drainage systems, as well as building new tunnel control buildings and making some earthquake safety improvements. This Sunday night, from 7:30 p.m, the public will be able to head along to see the work for themselves by walking through the safer, modernised tunnel for a small gold coin donation in aid of Wellington Children's Hospital. Nationally, government has increased investment in state highway projects by more than $1 billion during its first term to promote economic growth and productivity, and that investment is now delivering real benefits. We've also committed to investing a further $12 billion over the next decade in state highway construction. In terms of ministerial activity, I'm in Wellington tomorrow and Wednesday. I'm in Auckland on Thursday and Friday, and depart for Korea on Saturday. In terms of the House this week, we'll continue to progress the search and surveillance bill through the committee stages in third reading. Wednesday is, of course, a Members' Day.
On tunnel, will you be attending the funeral?
Not sure at this stage. It will depend on when the funeral takes place. I'm going to talk to the Prime Minister about logistics and any way that New Zealand might be able to help in a few moments. If it's when I'm in Korea, then my guess is the Foreign Minister. Certainly the Governor General will attend and teach the Deputy Prime Minister. If it's later, then I may have the opportunity to go.
When does this leave our relationship with Tonga?
Well, it's an incredibly strong relationship. It's one that has got a deep history, and one where we're lucky enough to have many New Zealanders of Tongan ethnicity. And the reality is nothing changes because of this, except a great sadness and a big hole that's left in the hearts of Tongans as they lose their king.
Do you have any plans for any sort of special commemorations here?
It's just far too early at this stage, and I'm sure we'll have a look at that issue, and that may well be the case that it's appropriate that we do something.
Do you have any reports on whether it's likely to affect the process of democratisation in Tonga, or the process of freeing up those sorts of institutions that the king is undertaking?
It's too early to tell on that. I mean, obviously the King was very forward-leaning in terms of wanting to see the advancement of democracy and made great strides in his time at the throne. It will depend, obviously, on his successor.
And you don't have any reports on his leaving?
He was the former Prime Minister. I think he's in Australia now, actually, so very limited at this stage.
Are there any concerns about violence again now?
Well, we certainly hope not. I mean, the government seems very settled. Prime Minister's doing a good job, so we would hope that there'll be a smooth transition.
Have you been advised that someone other than the Crown Prince
would
be the successor?
I haven't, no. In the own discussions I've had with the Minister of Foreign Affairs, all the indications would be the Crown Prince.
Prime Minister, can I ask you about the Algerian custody case?
Yeah.
What service, I guess, is the New Zealand government providing to the
Look, I don't have any updated information. I mean, it's obviously a custody dispute between effectively two New Zealanders, as I've said before, and we're continuing to work and give support. It's about the legal rights and the legal process, which is, as you'll probably be aware, very limited in Algeria.
They've asked for more ministerial, high-level help. Yeah. Is that even possible in a case like this?
Well, it's always possible for diplomatic diplomacy. We haven't engaged on that at this point. I haven't formed a view on the rights or wrongs of the custody dispute, other than it's important that we provide support when people ask for that support. But I think we'll be quite a long way from wanting to intervene in that regard. And the work, as I understand it, have been our people on the ground, obviously in Egypt, travelling over, and providing advice on the merits and benefits and the likely process that would need to be followed.
Your Auckland Housing comments got a bit of a response this morning, and you noted supply lagging demand. Do you think there's anything else the government can do to help boost the supply of affordable housing?
Yeah. Well, first thing I'd say is supply isn't lagging demand. It's why house rental prices going up. I mean, it's quite clear that there's some. Herald's been running a significant number of stories about shortages for people as they look for rent. I mean, one of the changes, it's one of the reasons why I'm not a fan of capital gains tax, but one of the changes of the government's tax package has seen less people investing in rental properties at the moment in the short term.
But could government do more to help boost the supply?
Well, we're obviously working very closely with the Auckland local government to make sure that the supply of land and the supply for the building sector is operating efficiently. We're looking at a number of legislative changes of things that we might want to do in other areas that would deliver greater efficiency in building. I mean, it's more pronounced and isolated in Auckland than the other parts of the country. We accept that, but it's also the home of about a third of all New Zealanders.
Just one thought on the ACC privacy breach case.
Yeah.
The Law Commission recommended last year that there be some sort of mandatory guidelines in cases like this for people being informed. Has the government looked at that, or are you doing any good for it?
We don't know about that specific issue. I mean, what I can say is ACC, as I'm sure we have looked at this particular issue, they have formed the view that it was, if not an isolated issue, it was a human error, if you like, and those can occasionally do occur. Matters now for the Privacy Commission, as you're aware, and the police, and ACC will be working with both those authorities if required. Certainly the Privacy Commission, they are working with them.
Have you got some sort of mandatory guidelines, though? Would you be open to that idea?
Mandatory guidelines for?
So for reporting when there's been breaches of privacy.
Well, I think the ACC themselves will accept there's some internal lessons that could have been learned. I mean, my understanding of the situation is that when they were informed that there'd been a privacy breach, that the staff member at ACC wrote to the complainant indicating that they wanted the material returned or that the material should be destroyed. Now, there's an argument about whether that person should have kept that up to another layer of management or potentially informed the police of that situation. As I said, they didn't, and I'm sure ACC's learned from that experience. But as I say, I see it more as not a solely isolated instance, it may be others, but it's not a frequent occurrence. And they do, in fairness to them, deal with 1.6 million complaints a year.
Do you think ACC should have informed the clients who potentially had their information leaked that it was out there and could be put in the public domain or be known to other people? Like, there'd been a privacy breach, you know?
Well, I think the staff member took the right step initially in terms of documenting what they believe took place at the meeting and then entering correspondence with the complainant. But I think there's a missing step there that should have been taken to the next level to determine what could have happened next. And one option obviously could have been to proactively engage with those that were on the file. Another certainly could have been to refer it to the police straight away, who would have the power to intervene and get that information back before it came into the public domain.
Do you think the truth here between the two? Because ACC seems to claim that effectively it was being blackmailed, and the person who leaked the information says no for the idea of ACC. I mean, what's your assessment of where the truth lies?
Well, it's not for me to arbitrate that. I mean, that's now a matter before the police, and I'm sure before the time they'll ask those questions. There seems to be quite a significant paper trail, and so they'll have to work their way through that. I expect ACC as a Crown entity to be honest and open with the government, and I've got no reason to believe that any of the information they have supplied us is incorrect.
Do you think it's appropriate for someone as politically well connected as Michelle Bogue to act as the advocate for a claimant in a situation like that interview in December?
Well, there's effectively nothing stopping her. She doesn't have an official function at the National Party anymore, unless she may. I'm sure she's still a National Party member. I see from time to time at events. There's nothing stopping her doing that, advocating on behalf of someone. I mean, I know the complaint. I met her when I first came into politics. That was right after she'd had the accident, from memory. For a number of years, she had mentioned to me when I was at events her frustration with ACC. So it was well known, though to the best of my knowledge, I hadn't seen her for a very long time.
Do you think, though, that because Michelle is quite politically well connected, that might have coloured the decision not to kick this matter upstairs?
No, I don't think that's correct, no.
Have you asked Julie Collins for an assurance that neither she nor anyone from her office leaked the details of this woman's name and the email from Michelle Bowie?
I have asked her, just as a matter of course, that she's given me an absolute assurance that she didn't.
So she said it didn't come from her and it didn't come from her office?
Correct.
And has she sought those same assurances from ACC?
I'm not quite sure if I asked her that question, but the question I asked her is, where was the information sent to from the complainant? It was sent to one of her staff members and to her directly. It was forwarded, as she relayed to me, to the chief executive and the chairman, and it was never given any wider distribution from them. And again, I think she's very confident that the email trail would demonstrate she's being accurate.
And if it was bound to come from ACC, what would be your view then?
I wouldn't want to answer that hypothetical question today.
On a slightly lighter note, can I ask you what you think about the giveaway rule changes?
It won't be a lighter note if someone hits somebody, but I've done the test. I got 8 out of 9. I would have got 9 out of 9 if my staff member who's standing behind me didn't misinterpret the situation I was facing. I'll deal with him later.
So you're blaming the officials?
I'm blaming Kevin Taylor. Thanks very much.